So yeah, last time we talked about your life and career, which is what we normally do in this podcast, but there's a few questions I wanted to ask you about philosophy and artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to go for a few things, but firstly, I was interested as a philosopher, what is it about AI that you're kind of drawn towards? What kind of questions interested you initially?
I'm mostly interested because of the way it might cast light on the way humans work. I mean, humans are very mysterious. I mean, they're different from other animals. We seem to have all kinds of mental powers and abilities that other animals don't have. Very unusual thing. If you take a kind of long-term temporal perspective on life on Earth, there's been life on Earth for maybe 2 billion years, multicellular organisms for 500 million. And there have been humans like us for maybe only 100,000 years, 150,000 years. And so what happened? I mean, that's the thing I'm interested in, and trying to recreate the same kind of abilities in machines. It's a very good way of probing what it is that we've got that the other animals don't have. So I think that's my main. I mean, of course, it's exciting to have a machine that can do fancy things, but in itself, that doesn't excite me, entertain me so much as the comparison with humans. And are we just like these machines? Are we different? And so on.
If you see a distinction, maybe there isn't one. Mm-hmm. Do you think philosophers bring something to the thinking around AI that science maybe does differently? Do philosophers have a pretty unique way of conceptualizing AI and how it works and the future of it and things like this?
Philosophers are much more interested in the question I just aired. I mean, that's what has always been the philosophical angle on AI. Can you remember in the early days of AI, there was a distinction made between AI as just enterprise of developing machine intelligence as tools for doing various jobs, and AI as a possible way of modeling the human brain. And philosophers have always been interested in the latter aspect, partly because they're interested in the mind, philosophy of mind, philosophy of psychology, philosophy of cognitive sciences, all to do with trying to figure out how the human mind operates. Whether philosophers have anything special to add to just the development of machine intelligence, I don't know. Just thinking, so Cliff Hinton, who's often referred to as the godfather of AI and been very important in the development of deep neural nets and the advances that have come with that, we were philosophy undergraduates together in Cambridge, I don't know how to say how long ago, more than 50 years ago, and we were in the same reading group, and I haven't seen much of him since, except I did meet him at a conference in London just a few months ago. And it was, he said, "Oh, David, you've changed." I said, "Well, what do you expect?" You know, it's 50 years plus. So, I mean, that's a kind of philosophical influence into the development of AI. But whether the philosophy helps with the technology, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure about that.
I wasn't aware that Jeff Hinton started off doing a philosophy.
He switched while an undergraduate from philosophy to psychology. And Cambridge was always a kind of bastion of neo-associationism. And when the rest of the world went kind of full-on high church computationalist cognitive science, Cambridge carried on developing associationist models. So Nick McIntosh and Tony Dickinson, two big names, done very interesting experimental work. And Jeff comes out of that tradition.
What was that distinction you just made between, was it two schools of thought around AI and thinking? Was it conversationalism and associationism?
Computationalism is a very general term, and we might talk about classical computationalism or high church computationalism. Is the view associated very much with MIT and Chomsky and coming to philosophy with Fodor, which is basically that the human mind is like a digital computer and it's got registers where you have data realized and it's got a program and the machine kind of goes through steps in a logical way and delivers conclusions. I mean, so the human mind works like a program computer. So that and the whole tradition of cognitive science is pretty much premised on that view. I mean, there used to be psychology, and then there was this new thing, cognitive science, and it involved not just psychology but linguistics, Chomsky linguistics, and philosophy. But the philosophical program is going to show how the mind is a digital computer. The opposed view is connectionism, which is no, the mind is a neural net, and just a bunch of connective neurons that are shaped by conditioning. I mean, classical Pavlovian conditioning and instrumental operant Skinnerian conditioning, and humans are just great big neural nets that get trained by experience. So those are the two opposed views. And Cambridge was rather of the latter view, and that's Jenkins' tradition. That's a big division. And then it's the fight's been going on for 1957, Chomsky slew the behaviorist dragon. He wrote the view of a review of Skinner's book, Verbal Behavior. And it was, the mythology is that he completely refuted the program of explaining the human mind in terms of associationist conditioning, and that's been the kind of conviction driving many people in cognitive science ever since.
How is your thinking around ideas like this and AI and intelligence and things in general changed over the last few years since tools such as maybe most notably ChatGPT has come out?
What's happened with the deep neural nets, and both in vision and in large language models like GPT-4, is they are completely unstructured neural nets. They're neural nets with a bit of hardwiring built in. So for the deep neural nets that do vision, that do image recognition, that do, I mean, all the things that on Zoom, Zoom can kind of focus in on the person talking and take them out of the background and put a different background in, all that. Being able to pick out the person, which is done by image recognition neural net. Those neural nets are kind of told that when you're trying to figure out, is there a cat in the picture, cats and other objects, they kind of move around as holes, that they're kind of, there's certain kinds of invariances in the way that physical objects move, and the machines don't have to learn that from experience. They're kind of structured so as to presuppose that from the start. And the large language models, similarly, I mean, a lot of the work in coping with language for humans and these new machines is, you've got words like it or words that are very Tunisimus, like ran. You've got to look back to figure out which bit of the conversation is telling you who it refers to, or which sense of ran. Am I running a business? Am I running a race? And you've got to somehow cotton on to which bits of the conversation go together. And so these very successful large language models like GPT, they don't just learn to predict the next word. They also learn, again, just by conditioning and reinforcement, which bits of the previous conversation to attend to in order to figure out what it or he or ran means. So they learn which bit of the context is relevant to understanding this word. And they're pre-programmed to try and figure out what to attend to. So again, they've got a bit of extra structure in. But basically, they're neural nets. So they're just given a tick. The connections are reinforced if they get the right answer, and given across, the connections are reinforced if they get the wrong answer. And that's all they are.
People always talk about them as these next token predictors, but you said it's that plus this little bit of extra context that they take into account.
Okay, so here's how they're trained. They're just great big neural nets, and they're trained on the internet, and they are given a bit of text, and then they guess the next word. I mean, at random. I mean, when they start, they're right. They reinforce if they get the right word, and not if they don't. And you just do that a lot, and eventually, they have been trained just by reinforcement to produce an appropriate next word, and that's all they do. So the extra thing I'm talking about isn't to do with them doing anything except producing an appropriate next word. Okay. The next thing I'm talking about is they were given a bit of a head start, a bit of a clue about how to learn to predict the appropriate next word.
Okay.
Right. So if I get a conversation that ends with it or he, and I somehow, I mean, I'm anthropomorphizing, but I somehow don't get which of the people being talked about before is he, then I won't be able to produce an appropriate next word. So I've got to learn how to disambiguate anaphora like he and it and so on, and how to disambiguate polysemous words like ran. I've got to learn how to do that, and in order to predict next word. So they're just predicting next word.
When humans are thinking and speaking,
yeah,
or they think, are we just predicting the next word?
That's a big question.
Yeah, I was going to say just as well, not that that would be unimpressive, because I think people often say that, don't they? They say, oh, how sad if we were just to be predicting the next thing, but the consequences are quite great, so I don't think it's
it's something. I think maybe GPT-3 or even earlier, there was a point where suddenly they could speak correct English when before they just hadn't been able to do it. And it was a kind of surprise and a shock that just being trained to predict the next word was enough to enable them to speak grammatical, cogent, indeed elegant English. And I was on various discussion groups on the internet, and I said to her, is it depressing to think that all fancy intelligent might just be we're here? I am burbling on when all that consists of is being able to choose an appropriate next word. And some of the people said, but why are you belittling that? And in fact, I mean, people's ability to, I mean, I don't put it in terms of predicting the next word, because there isn't any next word when I'm talking. I mean, I've trained myself listening to other people, seeing what, but listening to how people talk and so on. But the result is now I'm not predicting the next word. I'm choosing an appropriate, apposite next word. And what's more, people pointed out to me, my ability to do that is informed literally by, I mean, to the extent of a neural net, like a large language model, by all the things I've read before and all the things I've thought before and all the things people have said to me before. And I've probably got a rather different body of experience in that dimension than other people. And so my choice of the apposite next word is informed by all that, and in particular, by all the things that I myself have thought before. And so maybe it's not so miserable a little talent to be able to choose the next word. It's maybe that's all it is. Maybe that's all that Shakespeare had. And he was just very good at picking an appropriate next word.
Well, it seemed to work. So it doesn't matter how it happens exactly.
Until these large language models came out, I didn't realize that was all you needed for the design of a intelligent. We can talk more about how intelligent a next word predictor is, but enough intelligent to be able to speak perfectly grammatical, perfectly elegant, and perfectly coded in appropriate English. You think, well, how are we going to set about constructing a machine to think thoughtful-looking English sentences? It wouldn't have been obvious to me that all you need to do is train it to predict next word. But I think people have had that idea for quite some while, going back 10, 20 years. And the real advance has been not so much the idea of making an excellent predictor, and that kind of learning what to attend to, I think, was an advance in the last 10 years or so. But in the power of the machines. And it's very striking that GPT-4 was quite a step up from GPT-2 and GPT-3, and its number of nodes and connections is kind of comparable to the number of neurons and connections in the human brain. And it was getting up to that scale that made these things really work.
Just to go back to something you said a second ago, you said, it doesn't seem like you predict, you choose what to say next, but is it not the same thing? By prediction, I was thinking that, like, when you choose what to say beforehand, you predict what word would be sensible to say. You then choose that word and then you say it.
Here's a good reason for thinking that humans might just be. Let's put it in terms of next word predictors. But remember, it doesn't quite make sense that I'm now a next word predictor, or even the GPT-4 is a next word predictor, because it's not like there's some pre-existing text and we're trying to guess what's the next word. We're producing the text. And so maybe we should say a next word producer. And you're trained to be a next word producer by being rewarded and punished. And how good you are at predicting the next word of pre-existing text. But now we've done the training, there's no pre-existing text, you're a next word and next word producer.
For when it produces the next word,
yeah,
is not the way that it produces that next word, which you write, it now just produces based on a calculation, a prediction of the word that it should most likely be successful in guarantee, like a kind of thumbs up at the end of the string of words. Isn't that how it produces?
Yes and no. But how do I produce the thoughts that I do? And whether I'm thinking in my mind or I'm speaking out loud now, how do I produce the thoughts? Well, you might think, well, first of all, I've got some thoughts, and then I figure out how to put them into words, that's going to be regressive. I mean, you don't want to have, before I produce the thought, I've got some other thought that leads me to this thought. You've got to have a system which is generating thoughts on the basis of something else that isn't already thoughts. And when you think about my doing some calculations in order to choose what to think or say next, that's kind of regressive. Now I've already got some thoughts before the thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
You want a system that is going to maybe be prompted by, I mean, large language models have prompts, be prompted by some input, something you say to me or something I read or some question that's asked, and then no more thinking, just the thoughts come out. And the challenge is to think, what's a machine that could generate thoughts in response to a prompt, not on the basis of prior thoughts? And what we've got is just a great big device with lots and lots of connections that's been trained. If you get an input like this, come out with that. And there's no thinking. We can try and analyze what's going on in the neural net, and people do. But I don't think it's helpful to think of what's going on in the neural net as itself reasoning or thinking. The reasoning and thinking is there in the output, in the structured sentences that come out. Those are what we should be thinking of as the thoughts. Now, I mean, the interesting questions about exactly how the neural net is structured and what is it sensitive to, and which has been, and if you like, what knowledge of the world is implicit in all the connections and then manifested in the outputs. But I think at first pass, you want to think of the thoughts being produced by the machine and thoughts being produced by people as the output of the net, and not as anything that's going on inside the net. So
yeah,
the net's a structured device which can generate thoughts out of nothing except props.
So the output is the thoughts.
Yeah.
Do thoughts require a thinker?
Yeah, well, we might come on to the question whether these machines are conscious, but why not already think of GPT thought as a thinker, which is producing these outputs, which are thoughts? To say that, you know, GPT-4 is not a thinker is pre-touching some questions. I mean, I don't think GPT-4 is a thinker. It's too simple.
That's good. I was going to ask about your thoughts on the kind of future iterations of these programs. So you say you wouldn't really regard GPT-4 as perhaps a thinker. What's missing? What would you expect to see in a system in a number of years to be able to think this is more suitable and to represent why I deem as a thinker? Is it some mistakes it's making at the moment? Some things don't seem quite right. What is missing?
I think the basic lack in GPT-4 is it doesn't look ahead at all. It's just always just predicting the next word. So
can you say a bit more about what that means? It's not looking ahead. It's just kind of, what would it mean to look ahead more?
You've got a lion and a rabbit and a lettuce on one side of the river, and you've got to get into the other side, and you can only take one at a time, and you don't want the lion to eat the rabbit, you don't want the rabbit to eat the lettuce. So what do you do? You got to leave the lion and lettuce behind, right? And take the rabbit, and then you go on. But I'm not sure if GPT-4 is good enough yet, but certainly I tried it on some large language models, and of course they get it wrong because they didn't. So they've seen this kind of problem now. So you say, well, wrong. We'll take one of the things. We'll take the lettuce, and then we'll come back and it'll get rabbit. And then you point out, hang on, look, you got it wrong. I mean, the rabbit would have gotten eaten by the lion by now. And it says, oh yes, I'm sorry, outside line. I can see that's wrong, but I better try something else. But it doesn't look ahead to see whether what it's going to end up with, if it starts off in the way it just did, is any good. I mean, it's got no ability to check its answer before it starts giving it. It's just doing it all from the top. That's a basic failing in a very simple next word predictor, which is doing nothing except each point doing the next word prediction. But at the same time, you can see it's not that hard to see how you might design a machine that will do better in that respect. Just get it to think before you talk. I mean, generate an answer and then check whether the answer is consistent, whether it gets where you want to, and which of course is what we do. I mean, we think ahead of it and see where our sentence is going, and it hasn't learned to do that. I mean, it hasn't been designed to do that.
If you ask it something like, what is a microphone, and it gives you a sentence that's coherent,
yeah.
And it gives you a sentence to try and answer your puzzle and it gets it wrong.
Yeah.
What is it about those kind of problems, as opposed to asking it to tell you what something is, that it gets it wrong? You say it can't see ahead. It seems to... It's maybe not seeing ahead, but it gets the full sentence right when you ask what's a microphone. What's kind of going wrong there? I can't quite picture why something goes wrong there. Is one that's more like a puzzle to solve? The other one is just kind of some more like knowledge?
Imagine you've got one of those little maze puzzles and children's puzzles, and how do you get from here to here? And so you try it, and then I go down this way, and I know, like, I get stuck if I go down this way, so I better start again. Large language models, as we have them, aren't allowed to try out the different routes to see which one will get to the right endpoint before committing themselves. Mm. And so with one of those mazes, the analogy is, I mean, a question you ask them, that you've got to start saying things to see whether where you end up is in the right place. They've got no ability before they give an answer, they can't say, okay, I'm going to start playing with this, and then that will lead me to say that, and does that make sense? They aren't able to wait until they get to the end. An answer that you only see if it's a good answer after you've rehearsed it, they aren't able to do that. As I said, they're just doing it from the top. It's just like setting out to find your way through a maze, but you're committed to the route that you start taking. So yeah, chances are half of them will be no good. Well, half of them will be no good.
I wonder how this issue will be solved then. The one about how that will change things too, so it solves problems such as the rabbit and the lion. We have to kind of see more ahead.
So
that's quite a technical question, I guess, but I wonder how.
My own feeling is that's not going to be very difficult. My feeling is that getting a machine to generate thoughts in the way that these large types of models can is the big breakthrough, and getting it to be sensible, to look ahead, to make plans, to break problems down into parts, that's going to be relatively easy. I mean, I think of it like this. I mean, I don't know if you know about Kahneman and Tversky and the thinking fast, thinking slow, system one and the system two.
I think you're not a fan of this. I saw it. Well, if you're,
I think it's oversimplified, but I'm a perfectly big fan in that there's all kinds of abilities we have kind of in virtue of being conditioned neural nets, all kinds of physical abilities, abilities to talk like I'm talking now, and abilities to categorize things and respond reasonably intelligently. But they're all rather quick and dirty. I mean, they're the upshot of trained neural nets, and they can be fooled by, you know, putting the mother in the messing around and so on. And then there's all kinds of formal techniques we get taught, like mathematics and logic and writing essays and kind of dividing things into sections and so on. All the things we're taught in school, taught in school for 20 years, all kinds of thinking slow, all kinds of techniques and disciplines and rules that have been developed by smart people over the centuries for avoiding the mistakes that our crude systems fall into. And I think what's going to happen with large language models is they're just going to be taught all the things that humans get taught in 20 years of school. And then they'll be just like us. But so far, I mean, they're basically like idiots. Savant is not quite the right word. Like somebody who's never been to school, kind of feral child who's learned English. They've been hanging around, they've heard people talking, they can burble away, but they've never been really constrained to be logical. They've never been taught to make sure that their thinking is consistent. They've never been taught to watch out for mistakes. And yeah, so I think they just need some schooling. Knowledgeable but not wise. Knowledgeable but not disciplined. They haven't got serious problem-solving techniques. I mean, in fact, I mean, they haven't really been set any problems in the first place beyond generating text. So getting machines to solve problems, to make plans, to work out steps about how to achieve some results. That's a more interesting thing. But as I said, I don't think that would be nearly as hard as getting them to speak languages.
Do you think these Claude and GPT-4 and these most up-to-date models pass the Turing test? And what do you think of the Turing test in light of things that are...
I think they pass the Turing test easily, but that ensures that the Turing test is not really a good test for intelligence. I mean, there's some debate about whether that's what Turing really had in mind.
Even if it fails at those, even if it hallucinates sometimes and fails at the kind of example you said earlier.
Are there questions that you can ask GPT-4, ask Claude to make them expose themselves as not humans? It's not so obvious. But I'm sure they are. I mean, they're things they don't get right. GPT-4 is much harder to trick than GPT-3, but... just trying to think, there was something I was asking it. I used to ask GPT-3, can it prove there's no greatest prime number? And it can't do it, it couldn't do it, because it's, you've got to make an assumption, assume there is a greatest prime number. And then you can't derive contradiction straight away. You have to argue an alternative. And that was too hard for GPT-3. GPT-4 can do it fine. So maybe we need some more tricky question. to. But hang on, this is supposed to be a Turing test. I mean, the number of people who can prove there's no greatest prime number is pretty small, so it's not going to tell you it's not a human being. Perhaps we should be talking more about how close these machines are going to be to being human beings and what we're going to do about that. The Turing test issue is going to be a real issue soon for many people. I mean, dealing with entities on the internet, you're really going to want to know, is this a person or is this a machine? And there are going to be contexts in which that's going to be consumed from you. And I mean, there's some debate about whether that should be outlawed straight away. Now, I mean, it should be required of all entities speaking to you on the phone or speaking on the internet. They have to declare whether they're human beings or not.
Can't you see any benefit, yeah, to not being honest about whether it's an AI? I don't see downsides, I think.
Well, I mean, think about customer services on the phone. You can think all kinds of corporations know that their customers would like to be out talking to a human being, but it's much cheaper to give them a machine. And if you can fool them into thinking it's a human being when it's a machine,
yeah,
you'll be way ahead of the game. But should that be allowed?
I suppose from a business perspective, it makes massive sense. I'm thinking as a user, although at the same time, actually, if I'm called up by a robot, customer service assistant, maybe it's helpful, maybe it's more helpful if that actually does the job, maybe I don't mind.
That'll be an interesting attitude. People are going to stop minding. Yeah. Okay, but there's a deeper issue. I mean, maybe there's going to stop being a difference. Maybe these machines will be just like people. Probably not. I mean, I'm only against machines, the possibility of machines being just like people, and I'm quite interested in the idea that some AI systems might be just like people, but I don't see why anybody should bother to make an entity on a customer services phone line just like a person. That would be unnecessary.
I wanted to get your views on AI, but this show is always about the kind of human and the human experience on the guest. So, one question I have for you was, as someone who's done philosophy their whole life and thought a lot about intelligence and these kind of issues, I'm just curious, the first time that you interacted with, maybe it was GPT, ChatGPT, or one of these models a couple of years ago, or a year, probably more like a year ago, wasn't it? I'm just intrigued what your experience was like doing that. Did you find it quite exciting?
I got very excited about large language models quite a while ago.
Okay.
And I'm just trying to, I think it was back in 2020. So I can't even remember now. Was it GPT-2? Was that the first one that could produce grammatically correct English? And Henry Shefflin, I don't know if you know him, he works at AM in Cambridge, is a chum of mine, and he showed me that he gave it a handout of my philosophy talk and then prompted it to do an interview with me. And so there was GPT asking questions and me responding to GPT. And it produced an interview, Henry asking me questions and so on, and he showed it to me, and I thought this was flabbergasting because it really read like the serious ish. I mean, and I couldn't really, really believe it. And I went around telling all my friends and relations this amazing thing has happened, and they didn't really know what I was going on about. And I said, look, we've now got machines that can talk and think in English, and And this was way big. I mean, wasn't really very good. And straight away. And it was OpenAI. It was the one that had 70 billion connection weights, which is far, far less than the ones now. But it was a kind of, nobody quite expected that that size would suddenly make all the difference, and it would be able to do languages just fine. And I was blown away straight away.
Do you play with them quite often still and try and get it to solve, you know, interesting questions like the one about the propagated prime number?
I play a bit. I got Claude to write a mock-up of my wife's weekly column in the newspaper. That was very funny. I showed it to her. She might write about it in the paper one time soon. But I use large language models, not the kind of things bolted onto the search engines, but I use them to find out some topic on the internet. Like, has anybody written about something I'm working on at the moment, anisogamy in plants, the evolution of anisogamy in plants? I mean, something that you would, in the old days, have used a search engine and you kind of found some article and half read it and then you'd follow it up and spend 5 or 6 hours kind of working through the internet trying to get a sense of what's been established and so on. And Claude will just do it for you straight away. It'll give you some idea of what's out there, what people have said. I mean, it's very useful in that way. It's not quite a search engine. It's asking for a digest of debates, and it's fantastic at that. So, yeah.
Just wanted to finish off by asking you about philosophy in the context of this kind of new era we're in.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think philosophy will be impacted by AI and these large language models in the next few decades? Or will that, due to age-old problems, will they resolve some of them?
I have no view about that. I mean, will successors of our current large language models become very good philosophers? Will they become better than humans at philosophy? I'm not sure. It's an interesting question. People are worrying about what it's going to make to philosophy teaching and philosophy learning and writing philosophy essays. And I think that's going to change. And I think everybody's going to start using large language models as a tool, as a helper for writing essays and writing texts and producing things. And we're going to have to learn how to, we're going to have to teach people and test them at being good at doing that. I mean, the idea we're going to kind of keep the large language models out of philosophy, people that carry on writing essays and they aren't allowed to use large language models. And that would be like saying, we're going to have kids going on doing mental arithmetic at school for the last 50 years. They're not allowed to have calculators because, that would be crazy. I mean, what we've got to do is teach kids how to use calculators. So I'm going to have to teach people how to use large language models to do the things they used to do with up. Maybe the machines will be better at some branches of philosophy than others. Maybe they'll be really good at philosophy of mathematics, but not so good at moral philosophy. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Imagine we have a system in the future that solves scientific problems we can't get our heads around over now. Maybe it helps us solve diseases. yeah. Certain scientific mathematical problems, and then we ask it for its view on what it means for something to be moral.
Yeah.
And it gives us an unusual answer. Do you think we should start to think perhaps there's onto something here?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, well, what one wonders whether we're going to design machines to have the same kinds of effective emotional responses to situations as humans do. And then it would probably do moral philosophy like us, but you could have intelligent machines who were outside those kind of reactions, and then they'd regard our reactions as a foreign thing. I don't know, it's very hard to think about these matters. Who knows what's going to happen?
David, that was great to speak. I've got many more questions I want to ask you about AI, and perhaps another time in the future we can chat again and ask you some more.
I'd be very glad to, Joe.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you enjoy the Human Podcast, please consider subscribing. I hope to see you soon.